Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with John Smart. John is the founder and president of Acceleration Studies Foundation at accelerating.org. He's the co-producer of the very successful Accelerating Change conferences, and his personal website is accelerationwatch.com. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me, James.
John, you've become known as one of the leading thinkers about social theories of complexity as applied to accelerating social trends. And so first, let's talk about the accelerations that you keep your eye on. What kinds of things are accelerating that you think are going to shape our future?
Well, this whole question of accelerating change is something that I first got introduced to in high school. I learned something that I later found out was called the cosmic calendar. This is this idea that if you put all of universal change on a calendar year, all the really interesting stuff happens toward the very end, and humans come out in the last few seconds of the cosmic calendar. And I discovered that Carl Sagan first popularized that in 1977 in a book called Dragons of Eden. But the calendar was actually taught even in the 60s. There was a geological calendar, and there have been calendars of human history, which also show just incredible acceleration toward the very end. So this topic has always interested me, and an individual by the name of Werner Vinge, science fiction author and mathematician, wrote an interesting essay called The Coming Technological Singularity, where he basically discussed various individuals who've extrapolated that this acceleration has to continue. And if it does continue, in certain areas, and the areas that he focused on were things like computation, then we're going to see computational complexity kind of zoom past human complexity sometime in this 21st century. And that kind of essay really galvanized a lot of people who were talking about accelerating change on the web. And by 1999, I realized that I needed to put a website up that really kind of collected the various thoughts of the thinkers in this area and how accelerating technological and computer complexity might interact with social complexity. And that was originally called Singularity Watch, which I renamed to Acceleration Watch, because the real issue is, as your question asks, is what are the accelerations that are going to continue and what are the ones that don't? So to address your question specifically, I think that there's lots of areas of technology and social change that don't accelerate indefinitely. They hit plateaus. They reach equilibria. And then there's others that, as far back as we can look, have continued to accelerate. The most classic example is growth in computer capacity. So many of us have heard of the term of Moore's Law. Gordon Moore in 1965 coined this term. He basically observed that transistor density on an integrated circuit was doubling every 18 to 24 months. And he predicted that if that continued, we would see chips with hundreds of thousands of transistors on them in the just the next few years. And, of course, that trend has continued and continues today. And individuals like Ray Kurzweil have written books that basically have shown that this computer acceleration has continued for at least 120 years since the first modern mechanical computers, which were things like, they looked like Jacquard weaving looms, and they were used to tabulate the U.S. Census in 1890. So certain types of trends continue to accelerate and others don't. I'm going to give you an example of one that's a controversial trend. There's people who are on both sides of this issue as to whether it will continue to accelerate kind of unstoppably in our lifetime, in our children's lifetime, and that's the trend toward increased transparency in our lives, increased public transparency. In a book by a science fiction author, futurist by the name of David Brin, wrote a really interesting book called The Transparent Society in 1998. And in that book, he basically noted that we're soon going to have, you know, gnat-sized cameras that can sit anywhere, you know, embedded in your clothing, and the ability to store on a hard drive in your cell phone basically all of the audio and visual experiences of your life, and then stream those to devices at home and elsewhere that will be able to convert that audio and video into text-searchable snippets of information, so that you'll have something that a futurist by the name of Jaime Casio calls a personal memory assistant.
That's an odd example, because for me, looking back on our tribal prehistory and then our small town and agricultural prehistory, it seemed like our lives were completely transparent to our neighbors back then. And then we achieved a certain degree of anonymity in the industrial and urban period. And now maybe it's going back in the other direction, but at least it seems parabolic to me. It doesn't seem like we went from total privacy to total transparency.
I think you're right on. I think that almost all social dynamics are what we might call pendular. They oscillate back and forth between two extremes. A classic example is the kind of pendulum of politics and economics. It's clearly swung from very democratic periods to highly plutocratic periods. An economist by the name of Brad DeLong noted this just 5 or 6 years ago, and he has an essay on the internet on this. Basically, the easiest thing to observe is the concentration of wealth, what you might call economic plutocracy or economic democracy, in the top and the bottom 5% of the country. And you see, since the founding of our republic, very clear swings between extreme plutocracy and very significant democracy. And I think that social transparency norms with regard to human beings are on those kinds of pendular cycles as well. The kind of transparency that I'm describing, however, is slightly different. I'm talking about the transparency of human intention, human action, basically the models of human beings in our electronic ecology, the environment that we're embedded in. A futurist whose name I can't recall right now said, human nature doesn't change from year to year. You know, it's dependable. You know, evolutionary psychology moves at glacial paces. But our houses get exponentially more intelligent with every year. So how does that change or sublimate the human being? And that's a question we're just beginning to ask. And, you know, David Brin basically said, you know, he didn't expect the human to be different, and he expected, you know, oscillating norms of privacy. You know, the kinds of privacy we would see in Nevada would probably be significantly different than the kinds we would see in Massachusetts or California. And so, and likewise with the world in the future. I think, you know, there's lots of social experimentation that's done, and pluralistic networks always seem to win out. They're the most robust systems. So we'll see lots of experiments with the kinds of privacy, public and private, that in public and private spaces that we have. But the computer ecology around us seems to be following one particular accelerating developmental trend, or not, you know, depending on which side of the fence you're on. Either our computers are just recording more and more of our lives, and we'll see a larger and larger kind of share of all of our public space freely available for view by ourselves and by any other human who's interested, you know, in this kind of transparent society, or we won't. We'll basically reach some saturation point where we'll say, you know, as Bill McKibben would say, enough. You know, basically, globally, we'll make a decision that, you know, this is all we need. And I'm going to segue now to another type of change that has significant social implications that seems much more clearly to be on a saturating trend, and that is world energy use and world population growth. You know, back in the 70s, we thought population was just going to continue to explode, and there were all these books about the topic, you know, The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich and such. And yet, the 1970s was roughly the time that the inflection point in the S-curve of global population growth was reached. So what happened was, the real short summary that some of the futurists that I read and write about discuss, was global development got advanced enough that having children became more of a liability than an asset. And social norms became advanced enough that people realized it was more important to invest in personal and child development than to invest their resources in having another child. So we started to see in all the developed countries, negative population growth. And the UN has really clearly, the demographers there have predicted that between 2030 and 2050, the world population will hit a maximum of between 7 and 11 billion human beings in the low and the high estimate.
That's one interesting wrinkle on that is that those who look at radical life extension, even with radical life extension, we would still only max out at around 12 billion. So that's a very optimistic scenario.
Yeah. And, another really interesting scenario, impact, a social and demographic impact of that is, as life extension gets better, the latest figures that I've seen say that, the median human being on the planet today is 26 years old. By 2050, the median human being is going to be at least 37 years old. I think that's the conservative estimate. They could easily be 40 years old. So we're going from 26 to 37 for the average age of the human being by mid-century. Now, another thing we can realize is that the kinds of educational technologies, we're talking about the digital ecologies of our computers and how they continue to accelerate, this intelligent house all around us. It's very clear now, there's really great studies. I'm going to recommend to the study called 2020 Visions. It's produced by the Office of Technology Policy of the Department of Education, I believe, 2020 Visions. And it's this beautiful study of kind of what the virtual reality education environments are going to be like, in just another 15 years. And now imagine a world circa 2050 where incredibly high-level educational interfaces exist. Now, somebody who's in their late 30s or early 40s in that world is going to be vastly more educated. Their experience is going to be vastly more tailored, specific, and valuable than the world that we exist in today, where really it's more of our biological capacities that determine, as far as how far we can go. In that kind of a world, as I've said in some of my internet writings, you're going to have a digital twin, a representative of you, an avatar out on the net that will be so semi-smart by then that you'll be conversing with it. And it'll be completing your sentences when you have a senior moment. Now, a digital twin that's that empowering is basically going to create a culture that's much less of a youth-obsessed culture than the one we exist in today. Because experience will really matter in that kind of a world.
It's interesting that you describe having such a powerful digital twin as empowering, because I'm sure some people see that as a horrific vision when something that is not a part of you becomes intelligent. So I guess the question is how much it'll be a part of you, which gets back to Ray Kurzweil's notion that it'll be basically a kind of running in parallel with your own brain.
Yes, and I wouldn't originate the notion with Ray. I think he's done a tremendous job of popularizing it. But yeah, we have to use this word transhumanist at this point. It's really the old transhumanist. It goes back to J.D. Bernal in 1920s and stuff. It's this old notion that really our technology is an organic extension of ourselves, and we don't yet understand that. It was a John McHale in the 60s said technology is as organic as a snail shell or a spider's web or a dandelion seed. And Brian Arthur at the Santa Fe Institute says technology is becoming organic, nature is becoming technologic. So that, of course, is another one of these interesting questions about the future. Is that trend towards increasing interdependence and intimacy of the human-machine interface, is that trend an accelerating developmental trend? Is it an unstoppable kind of wave that us change surfers are going to need to surf? Or is it a social choice that's going to differ widely from enclave to enclave? And I think it's a little of both.
By the way, the European Ethics Board just released a report on smart implants, and they I thought it was actually a pretty good report, but they had some of the bioconservative tropes in there about the threats to democracy and human integrity from having smart devices inside our body. But I'm speaking with John Smart. He's the founder and president of Acceleration Studies Foundation and co-producer of Acceleration Change Conferences. You can find him at accelerating.org. John, one of the things that's really fascinating about your perspective is that you bring in a lot more of the social dimension and even the spiritual dimension of these accelerations, a kind of utopian dimension, than many of the techno-utopians do, who just focus on what's going to happen when the deus ex machina pops out of the AI box. I think one of the folks that's been an inspiration for you is Teilhard de Chardin. Could you speak briefly about Teilhard's thoughts and how that might have shaped your own?
Yes, I wouldn't say that Teilhard's thoughts really deeply shaped my own, but I would say that he really confirmed this kind of fundamental idea that's been floating around for many years now, that there is actually a progressive dimension to universal change. There have been people really for over a century who've used various metaphors of kind of the universe as a computer, the universe as a developmental system. The idea that change, evolutionary change, actually has a direction to it, has a progressive direction to it. And, of course, these ideas, they pretty much originated with the early natural philosophers that were, of course, the theologians. And if you go back to, there's some cosmologies, the Jainist cosmology in 2600 before current era, really had a fascinating kind of world model that everything was composed of matter, energy, space, and time. And they even had two different types of energy, kinetic and potential. They had the energy of rest and energy of motion. And, you know, these cosmologies, you know, these spiritual world models were so, some of them, well, many of them were so kind of implicitly understanding that if we just play the game right, the entire universe seems to be rigged for increasing, accelerating, progressive growth, you know, and what I would call accelerating change, what Robert Wright would call a non-zero-sum or a positive-sum game. And his book, Non-Zero, I highly recommend for reading to understand kind of his idea that there's a mathematics of morality and, you know, a calculus of civilization built into the complex interactions that humans engage in social groups. And if that's true, there's some universal reason for this. There's some larger, bigger picture for why this occurs. And I'd say Teilhard de Chardin was the first really consistent kind of extrapolation of that within the Christian theology. This idea, you know, he was a Jesuit and a paleontologist, and he you know, didn't buy this kind of early Darwinian notion that everything is completely random in evolution. And, of course, there are many, many things that are random in evolution. In fact, the most valuable theory of evolution is called the neutral theory of evolution, which says at the molecular scale, everything is kind of a random walk. It's everything is driven by these chaotic oscillators. Yet, even though there's this kind of chaos at the base, and of course we know in quantum mechanics the chaos is so strange, it's, you know, it's fundamentally weird. Even with these fundamental chaotic mechanisms, we see these convergences that are highly predictable, and we see a direction. We see a directionality to evolution, which some of the best theorists are calling evolutionary development. So if you would like to read a book that's kind of the modern update of Teilhard de Chardin, he was writing in the 50s, and his famous book is called The Human Phenomenon, mistranslated to The Phenomenon of Man. You can also find that title out there. The best modern synthesis of this, I think, is written by an evolutionary developmental biologist, another paleontologist, by the name of Simon Conway Morris. It's called Life's Solution. And what he basically shows in this book is that intelligence, a higher order what Teilhard would call the noosphere, this emerging kind of global brain on top of the individual human beings that comprise society. Morris says that intelligence is kind of an inevitable developmental, statistically inevitable developmental emergence of evolutionary mechanisms. And he shows that all the higher features of intelligence that humans prize, all of our ethics, our emotions, our world models, you can find those in all kinds of other metazoans besides human beings. So there seems to be a direction, a direction towards accelerating intelligence and consciousness. And Teilhard was probably the first to really characterize that within a spiritual domain, which really, I think he basically put the original model of any philosophy, any theology, excuse me, is that if you do X, Y, and Z, the universe is biofelicitous. It is friendly to you, friendly to your purpose, friendly to the purpose of others. And that X, Y, and Z that you need to do, the ethical prescripts, basically the way you should live your life, proscriptive and descriptive, those things have basically morphed into a modern worldview that's much more humanist and much more scientifically informed. It's not yet scientifically grounded. We don't have a mathematics of morality. And this is an area, values is the area that the scientists are the most silent about, which is why religion still serves such a fundamental value to societies, and why, pluralistic religions, religions that really are ecumenical and really try to understand every other religious view as a slightly different view on the best that humanity has to offer, each religion with its own baggage, of course, those kinds of worldviews really serve a deep value still today, and I think they will until our science advances to the stage where we actually do have some grounding for understanding the universe as an information theoretic device, the universe as a system that is trying to understand itself, with humans as this piece of the universe, built by the universe to try and understand the universe, but not just understand. I think the two fundamental drivers, if you were to ask me for kind of a summary of my theology, are discovery and creativity. And evolution and development seem to be the two fundamental processes of change, of physical change, of biological change. So if development is all about cycles, it's all about sustainability, it's all about predictability, evolution is all about creativity, innovation, uncertainty, unknowability. And we seem to be doing some combination of both learning, developmental learning, and evolutionary discovery in everything we do. And a big insight for me was the realization when I first developed this paradigm and found it expressed in the works of other evolutionary developmentalists like Simon Conway Morris. A big realization for me was that Moore's Law, this accelerating computer complexity, this runaway of computer growth that we've all lived with, we were born into, and that our children are going to see in an even more stunning scale than we do, that whole thing, that whole acceleration, does not seem to be built on human creativity alone. If you really look closely at it, the acceleration of computer complexity occurred right in the middle of the Great Depression, just as much as it did in World War II. And so, as Kurzweil and a few others have speculated, the reason that occurs is because it just takes a small number of curious human beings fiddling around in the right space, and they don't create these accelerating computer solutions. They discover them. They're actually built into the physics of the microcosm of the universe. So we actually have a very strongly non-zero-sum game rigged in to the structure of the universe that rewards accelerating computational complexity, self-understanding, and other understanding, the farther down we drill into the microcosm of the universe that we inhabit.
That's very, very interesting. But let me take a brief detour from the extremely sublime to the somewhat more mundane, which is that when you talked about the humanist ramifications or the humanist interpretations of global brain theory, one of the writers who's written about that is Greg Stock in the book Metaman, and also Howard Bloom, and you also mentioned Robert Wright in Non-Zero. Yeah. And with the exception of Robert Wright, most of the folks who seem to be have a global brain orientation, a secular global brain orientation, or a religious one for that matter, don't seem to think that humanity developing or humanity and its technosphere developing an intelligence at a global level will necessarily lead to global governance. And I've been a longtime advocate of global governance, and I just wanted to press you on that point. Do you think that, as Robert Wright does, the global governance, if not global government, is a necessary and inevitable next stage of evolution for the human race?
Actually, I don't think it is. No, I believe that when you use the term global governance, it's much more credible, and I do believe that we will see much stronger mechanisms and more redundant and pluralistic mechanisms of global governance as going forward into the future. But the various writing that I've been most influenced by on this is something called network theory. Barabasi's book, I think it's called Linked. There's a number of interesting books that talk about networks, Duncan Watts' Small Worlds, the so-called 6 degrees of freedom, how closely linked we are in the network with everyone else. And if you look at societies as collective computational systems, it seems like these amorphous networks, highly pluralistic, where no one system has real significant hierarchical control over large pieces of the rest of the system. What Kevin Kelly succinctly described in his book, Out of Control, those kinds of systems seem to outcompete all the others because they seem to be the kind of the optimal trade-off between unpredictable evolutionary innovation and predictable hierarchical developmental cyclic control. And so, you know, for me, I could picture a world in 2050, let's say, where, you know, 80% of the world is under a pretty strong global governance. And then there's another 20%, you know, this 80-20 model of Pareto, the Italian economist, that is not. And it's not under that control for very important reasons. There always needs to be kind of some open source, much less regulated, maverick element within the system, disrupting the system to some degree. But that 20% that isn't under control, you know, they're going to be much more carefully watched than the kind of world we're in today.
You've been listening to the first half of an interview with John Smart, the director of the Acceleration Studies Foundation and the founder of the Accelerating Change Conferences. You can find his work at accelerating.org. Check back next week for the second half of the interview when we talk about the relevance of accelerating trends for global equality and global governance, or listen to it at changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.